The Al-Qaeda martyrs of 2001 had succeeded beyond al-Sadiq's wildest expectations. The Americans had then focused their efforts on hunting down a wealthy Saudi who had taken refuge in Pakistan. Fools. Iran had used al-Qaeda as a proxy force to strike at the heart of the West. It was masterful. General Jafar al-Sadiq was proud of his triumph. Now bin Laden was dead, shot down by American SEALs. Had he taken refuge in Iran, he might still be alive.
The Americans are nothing without their technology. They are soft. Yes, they are soft, but now they know the truth. They have already shifted focus to Iran. You underestimated them? Perhaps. But as before, we must adapt.
U.S. and U.N. inspectors were scouring the country to dismantle the programs designed to defend the Islamic Republic from the infidels. The president had not stood up to the invaders this time. Perhaps a regime change was in order. As director of the Ministry of Intelligence, Jafar was one of the few with the power to alter Iran's trajectory. He still had work to do. Sleeper cells remained embedded in the Western world. If they continued to welcome those who wanted to destroy them inside their gates, it would be the death of them. Allah would see to that. The feeble Americans had never set foot in Iran. Instead, they labeled the regime a state sponsor of terror. They applied sanctions. They issued harsh rhetoric, not realizing that their weakness allowed Iran to shape the next generation of fedayeen, a new generation of holy warriors determined to see the United States in ruins. It might not happen on Jafar's watch, but it was inevitable. A space in the beachfront structure had been converted to a musalla years ago, a prayer room reserved for those warriors of the Prophet Muhammad who would come to Chalice to rest and plan. It had seen considerable use since the Americans invaded Iraq. Al-Sadiq entered the sacred chamber, faced the Al-Kaaba al-Musharrafa in Mecca, placed his AK at his side, and began to pray. Chapter 78. They had launched out of the Iranian fishing town of Jirebagh, just east of Dastak on the edge of the Caspian Sea, and trolled the waters off Chalice. No strangers to this southwestern part of the Caspian, the four-man crew had two additional passengers on this run. They were after beluga caviar, the salt-cured eggs from female sturgeon, so sought after by those with means. Classified as a critically endangered species, the sturgeon was nearing extinction. To the fishermen aboard the trawler, it simply meant their catch brought a higher price on illicit markets. Iran was not a country known for adhering to international norms and conventions. As with most prohibited substances, the prohibitions created even more demand. The same networks that moved people, drugs, and weapons also moved illicit wildlife. In this case, a portion of the income generated from smuggling illegal roe helped fund the PJAK, the Kurdistan Free Life Party, a Kurdish separatist group classified as a terrorist organization by the Iranian regime and the United States. Though the CIA was prohibited from having any official connection to the PJAK, those who worked in the charcoal gray area of the clandestine service knew the value of maintaining relationships with the enemy of one's enemy. The caviar smugglers were about to receive a healthy payday to help fund the resistance, while at the same time removing an Iranian official involved in what amounted to a genocide against the Kurdish people. The boat had red paint markings to signify they had paid the appropriate bribes to the right officials to prevent boarding and inspections. The fishermen had their orders. insert their package off the coast of Chalice, 125 miles to the southeast, and continue on their usual path. They were to return to the waters off Chalice 2 days later, wait until just before dawn, and then continue back to their home port if their package failed to return. Reese had entered Iran through Iraq by way of Turkey. The agency maintained a base in Erbil for their Peshmerga fighting force despite the official policy of the United States toward Kurdistan. The CIA-trained direct action force also ran operations into Iran across borders the Kurds did not recognize, gathering intelligence and atmospherics and distributing cell phones into the black market, loaded with spyware from the whiz kids at Langley's Directorate of Science and Technology. Kurdish smugglers moved everything, from weapons to cigarettes to alcohol to cars to jeans to illegal drug precursors to walnuts. 2 nights ago, they had smuggled in their first American. The phones the Kurds had been feeding into Iran's economy had penetrated the upper echelons of the Iranian military and intelligence apparatus and had led to the death of Quds Force General Qasem Soleimani at Baghdad International Airport. That same technology had given the CIA access to Jafar al-Sadiq's travel schedule. The American hadn't said a word to anyone other than the Iraqi who accompanied him. When they spoke to one another, it was only in whispers. A traditional shemagh covered his head and face, obscuring his features. They could tell he was bearded, dirt and dust visible around eyes that seemed to change from brown to green depending on the light or his mood. A chameleon. The man sat watching the coast or looking north, out to sea. He accepted the offered tea and dates. The intensity radiated by his calm, silent focus made them nervous, but his companion helped put them at ease. They had been instructed to only call him Mohammed, but they heard the American call him by another name, Mo. When Mohammed wasn't whispering to the infidel, he shared stories and cigarettes with the crew. His easy smile, dark, slicked back hair, and dashing looks made them all feel comfortable with what they were about to do. Around midnight, the American unrolled a dirty rag from his satchel and began to assemble what the fisherman recognized as a Kalashnikov, though this one had a thin metal stock that folded under the weapon. One of the smugglers had seen his share of fighting and recognized the flip-up grenade sights, three cutouts on the handguard, and Arabic markings identifying it as a Tabuk, named in honor of the Prophet Muhammad's final military expedition. The fisherman watched as their passenger ran his thumb over a symbol of the Lion of Babylon engraved on the left side of the rear sight block. The mariner found himself wondering what or who the man was remembering. They watched as he carefully wiped down the bolt and applied grease to its stem and triangular lug with his finger. He then wiped grease on the bottom of the bolt lugs and across the lower portion of the bolt carrier assembly. When it was finished, he attached what they knew as a silencer to the end of the barrel. He then pointed it out to sea, reached under the weapon, and racked the charging handle with his left thumb. He pushed the selector to its top position and pressed the trigger. Nothing happened, indicating the safety worked as intended. The smugglers watched their passenger move the selector lever to the bottom position and press the trigger. He was rewarded with an audible click. He then racked the charging handle again, with his finger still retaining the trigger reward in the pulled position. As he released the trigger, another audible click could be heard as the trigger's disconnector returned the hammer to a ready-to-fire state, confirming that the weapon functioned properly in semi-automatic. He then moved the selector to the middle position and pulled the trigger. Click. He racked the charging handle a third time, keeping the trigger depressed. This time he slowly rode the bolt home, hearing the automatic click of the hammer as the bolt seated into battery. He then released the trigger. Silence. No click permeated the night air, which verified that the hammer had followed the bolt home on the rifle's fully automatic setting, exactly as its inventor had envisioned. With what the fisherman could tell was practiced efficiency, the American inserted a dark metal magazine and clicked it into place. He then racked the charging handle, returned the selector to the safe position, and pulled the bolts back slightly to ensure a steel casing gleamed back. Americans were strange. He reached into his bag, stood, and lifted a dark green chest rig with what looked to be three magazines over his head, adjusting it before sliding his arm through the sling of his rifle and moving it to his left side. The fishermen had never seen anyone handle an AK like that before. They'd shot a few themselves and had only put in the magazine and pulled back on the charging handle before letting loose on full auto. The rifles had worked every time. He then did something even more peculiar. The foreigner pulled out what looked like a trash bag and snapped it open to fill with air. He pushed more than half the air from the bag, tied it off, and stuffed it into his satchel. He stood and whispered something to his companion. The two men hugged in the way of old friends. Then the American slipped over the side and disappeared into the Caspian. Chapter 79. Reese pushed the satchel in front of him as his legs worked beneath the surface, propelling him toward shore. The air-filled garbage bag provided flotation, and Reese rested the venerable AK on the leather satchel. He was confident it would work, even when filled with sand and salt water. That was the genius of Kalashnikov's iconic design. Even so, Reese did his best to keep it dry, just to be safe. He could see the lights of Chalos ahead. From the water, it appeared no different from any other seaside town or coastal city in which he had trained or operated over his time in naval special warfare. In this case, he'd studied the coastline years ago when he and his team had waited for the green light to capture or kill Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a mission approval that never came. Tonight, that training and those rehearsals would prove valuable. He didn't come in directly on the urban center of Chalos, choosing instead to come ashore at the far eastern end of the beach, an area devoid of lights. 50 yards from shore, he paused, holding his homemade flotation device and treading water with his legs as he scanned for threats. He tasted the salt of the Caspian on his lips, its strength diluted by the numerous freshwater inflows to what was essentially the world's largest lake. The water was cold, even this far south of the Volga. Being immersed in a maritime operating environment was not a new experience for the former frogman. Without a wetsuit or dry suit, Reese felt oddly more in tune with his surroundings than he had since he'd ventured across Siberia the year before. He also knew he couldn't scan the shoreline all night. He had some place he needed to be. It was imperative he get into position before the sun came up. His local dress, the satchel that fit the underfolder, stocked, Iraqi-manufactured AK, and Shima would allow him to pass at first glance. Anything other than a cursory inspection and Reese was going to guns. The PBS-1 suppressor and subsonic ammo would buy him time. How much time? That was an unknown. Satisfied that this section of the resort town shoreline was clear, Reese alternated between breaststroke kicks and scissor kicks and drove himself toward his target. I come from the water. Chapter 80. Placing his mind below his heart in the position of prostration, kneeling to symbolize submission to God, Jafar al-Sadiq was tranquil and at peace. He moved from kneeling to sitting for the final verses of Isa, which he internalized, eyes closed and focused.
Allahumma inni a'udhu bika min atabil kabri, wa min atabi jahannama, wa min fitnatil maya wal mamati, Wamin shari fitnatil masihi dajjal. O Allah, I take refuge in you from punishment of the grave, from the torment of the fire, from the trials and tribulations of life and death, and from the evil affliction of the false Messiah. Allahu Akbar. A'udhu billahi min hashaytanir rajim.
Before he could finish the verse, Ja'far al-Sadiq felt the pressure change in the small room as a door opened behind him.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
He completed the prayer. He turned his head to bark at the guard and instead found himself staring down the barrel of a rifle. The candles provided just enough illumination to identify the suppressor protruding from the end of a Kalashnikov held by a tall man, head and face wrapped in a beige and black shima, a cloth rig of extra magazines strapped to his chest.
"Who are you?"
Ja'far demanded in Farsi. The man moved to Jafar's left, kicking the AK out of arm's reach.
"Guard!"
Ja'far yelled.
"They won't hear you. Not until you join them anyway," the man said in English.
"American. You are American,"
Ja'far said, switching to English. The AK's selector lever was in the down position on semi-automatic, and the man's finger was on the trigger.
"You really shouldn't be so afraid of dogs. Had you cleared this place with them, you might not have died tonight."
"What do you want?"
Ja'far asked, attempting to get to his feet.
"You can stay on your knees, General. This won't take long."
Ja'far settled back on the ground, calculating distances to the door and to his AK in the corner.
"Who are you?"
With the Kalashnikov still trained on the veteran of terror, Reese reached up with his left hand and pulled the shema around and down to hang loosely at his neck. Ja'far's eyes widened in recognition.
"I know you."
"You don't know me. You may know who I am, but you don't know me."
Ja'far's eyes narrowed.
"And you are here to execute an old man on his knees."
"Not an old man. An enemy.
A terrorist."
"Ah, yes. A terrorist,"
Ja'far said thoughtfully, bringing his eyes up to meet his intruder's gaze.
"You Americans are so fond of that word. War on terror. Dropping bombs from the sky and killing entire families with drones. The world knows the real terrorists, Mr. Reese."
"And Beirut? 9/11? Marburg?"
"Don't insult me, Mr. Reese. Beirut would be a legitimate military target even by your definition of terrorism. I've read your literature. Car bombs are the poor man's air force."
"And 9/11? Marburg?"
"You and the Israelis give us no choice. This is a struggle for the soul of the world. It always has been about religious and economic domination, bringing the Holy Land under Kafir control. The objectives of the Crusades are still very much the goals of U.S. foreign policy."
Reese shook his head.
"Where do you think that fool bin Laden got his fatwa?"
Ja'far asked.
"From al-Zawahiri? The brains of the base? He is too smart to tip his hand that way. That Al-Qaeda fatwa came from me."
Ja'far bowed his head again and recited the fatwa that had been a declaration of war against the West, a war that only one side recognized when it was issued in 1998.
"To kill the Americans and their allies, civilians and military, is an individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it."
"You killed innocent men, women, children, even fellow Muslims," Reese said.
"I think you Americans coined the term collateral damage. They are martyrs for the cause and sit at the right hand of Allah.
Before you join them, I have a message for you to send the regime.
A message? I think you sent that message when you shot down a diplomatic aircraft over the Atlantic.
This message is more specific.
A message from an assassin. I'm curious, Mr. Reese. The United States does not typically employ assassins. If they do, they are expendable traitors recruited from the lands of Allah, brainwashed, wound up, and sent off to do the West's bidding. You are known for dropping bombs on innocent women and children from above, not sending assassins like this.
I'm not an assassin.
Then what are you?
I'm a messenger.
Jafar grunted.
And what message would you have me pass to the regime?
Just this, Reese replied. He leveled the AK at General Jafar al-Sadiq's face and depressed the trigger. The 7.62x39 bullet entered just to the left of the right eye. The round caved in the right side of the general's head, a mass of brain tissue hitting the wall behind him and sliding to the floor of the Musalla, showering the area in a dark red mist. He collapsed on his right side, blood seeping into the prayer rug. The man who had collaborated with Al-Qaeda and provided them materials, support, and sanction, and who had ultimately approved the plan for September 11, 2001, and the bioweapon attacks on its 20th anniversary, was killed by an American on Holy Land. Reese stepped forward and followed up with two more rounds to the head to ensure his target was dead. He then slung the Kalashnikov and removed a chain from around his neck. He held the ring between his fingertips, remembering Lauren and Lucy, and wondering what would have happened had Jen survived that Tuesday morning in September. Would two American cities now be smoldering piles of rubble? Did her death inadvertently save 500,000 lives? Reese knelt, opened Jafar's left hand, and placed the ring inside. He pressed the dead man's fingers around it in a fist.
"They'll get the message," Reese whispered.
The messenger then made his way back through the house just the way he'd practiced in his team's rehearsals all those years ago, when al-Zarqawi was planning the Iraq insurgency from this very compound. He worked his way through the shadows past the bodies of Jafar's four bodyguards. He climbed the back wall and dropped into a dark alley, sinking into the shadows, as he listened for any sounds that betrayed his presence. He stood, folded the stock under the AK, and placed it in his satchel. He then adjusted his shima and walked toward his extract. He hit the beach and made his way to the water's edge, feeling the sand give way beneath his feet, just as it had in Coronado all those years ago. He could see the fishing trawler loitering 500 yards off the coast, trolling for sturgeon in the early morning darkness. He knelt behind a cluster of rocks protruding from the sand and scanned the slope that led to the street above. Nothing signified that a foreigner had invaded or that one of the most formidable terrorists in the world had just met his maker. He had sent the message. It was time to go. Reese took one last look, then turning, moved through the light shore break, out beyond the waves toward the beckoning sea. Epilogue. I have a message from God unto thee. Ehud the Assassin, Judges, chapter 3, verse 20, King James Version. Ulcinj, Montenegro. The envelope arrived via courier early that morning. Nizar Khatan tipped the boy a 5-euro note and rolled the letter over in his hands. It had traveled a long way. Although originally developed to transfer money, in the modern world the ancient system of hawala persisted as the most secure way to pass information. With the CIA and Mossad collecting electronic communications from almost every keystroke worldwide, sifting it through complex algorithms developed by the tech titans in the private sector, It was becoming increasingly difficult to remain anonymous in a data-driven economy. It amused Nizar that those technology-dependent intelligence organizations could be fooled by a handheld package trading hands and crossing borders with impunity. All one needed was time and patience. Nizar had been given multiple assignments in this fashion. All were profitable when coming from Masada. The Russian mafia had initially offered him refuge, but only because of an arrangement with a banished colonel. A colonel who had been turned into mulch when a PG-32V-105mm anti-armor heat round destroyed his armored Mercedes in Switzerland. Intelligence agencies and the media had pointed the finger at a terrorist known as Mohammed Farouk. Nizar wondered if he had really pressed the button that had killed the Russian colonel. It seemed too convenient. What the West liked to call the free press was not to be trusted. After the Odessa operation, Nizar had seen the writing on the wall. He was expendable. True, he'd always been expendable, but without Russian blood in his veins, it was only a matter of time before the Bratva separated his head from his body. He had always scoffed at those who had sacrificed themselves for Allah. Die? For the Prophet? For the cause? Nizar preferred to live for himself, not for a prophet or ideology. He'd seen too many young, idealistic warriors strap on suicide vests and martyr themselves for a religion they didn't even fully comprehend. That was not Nizar's way. He favored freelance work that benefited his multiple bank accounts. He'd done a job for the Bratva in Montenegro and never returned to the Russia that had become his base of operations after he sent a bullet at Russian President Zubarov. His partner's bullet had found its mark, eviscerating their target in front of the world. Nizar had adjusted and put his second shot into a man on a rooftop, a man who should have killed President Grimes. Nizar had read the papers. His round had not connected with his intended target. It had killed an American spy. It did not take much digging to associate that death with a funeral in South Carolina of a former Navy SEAL named Frederick Strain. The sniper wondered what Strain was doing on the rooftop in exactly the position of Nizar's mark. He should not have been there. Nizar had been hired to kill a member of President Zubarov's FSO security detail, a man with nationalist leanings and ties to Ukraine. Instead, his bullet had killed the American. General Yadid had passed him the details when he'd given him the order that had elevated Nizar to prominence as one of the top guns for hire in the business. He had felt nothing when he pressed the trigger on the suppressed Stechkin and sent the 9x18 round through the head of his partner, the legendary sniper known as Tasho Al-Shishani. The student had become the master. Now he worked alone and solved problems. That skill set put him on the radar of a company called Masada. The Masada CEO had told him he was free to work for anyone as long as they weren't other Americans. Masada wanted sole American rights, a demand to which Nizar readily acquiesced. Masada paid well. Eric Sawyer had brokered an introduction to Montenegro's president, a man who had previously served as prime minister, a politician who maintained power through connections with the Montenegrin mafia. He had recently been bestowed with the rather dubious honor of Person of the Year in Organized Crime by the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, an organization dedicated to ferreting out corruption through political links to the underworld. That's how things were done in Montenegro. Nizar was protected by the Montenegrin mafia through the president. He maintained two homes, a flat in the coastal city of Ulcinj and a mountain cottage in Zabljak. He preferred the Mediterranean climate and beaches of the ancient settlement on the Adriatic to the mountains of the northern region, but in his line of work it was wise to have options. With the influx of tourists in both areas, he was able to blend in. He was also learning English from the prostitutes run by the mafia in the port town. He'd grown up at war, and knew women served a purpose. The Ukrainian girl still slept. He enjoyed what she did to him in bed, and with her help, his English was improving. He knew she liked it when he was in town because he paid for her services and the mafia did not pimp her out to businessmen or criminals from abroad, many of whom used the powerless as heirs to their violent frustrations. The arrangement worked well for them both. Nizar did not use a cell phone or own a computer. He had operated without them for long enough to know that their convenience had a distinct and obvious downside. Early on, he noted a commonality between those the West took out with their drones and hit teams. They all used cell phones. Sometimes they even found those without the mobile devices. Bin Laden had found that out the hard way. Montenegro offered access to Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. But as soon as Nizar felt the tides shifting, he would be on his way to his next temporary home. Thailand? Panama? Argentina? There were options for a man with no ties. All one needed was capital. Nizar had grown to like the ancient seaport, a settlement that had once been the pirate capital of the Adriatic. The mafia ensured it remained connected to its roots. He varied his routine between the flat on the coast and the cottage in the mountains. He traveled enough to keep anyone tracking his movements from being able to discern distinct patterns. Though Nizar knew that no matter how many precautions he took, there would always be patterns. A skilled hunter just needed to be able to study him long enough to discern them. He bought and read newspapers at various shops in the city. There was one cafe by the water that he particularly enjoyed. When he needed to do further research, he would visit one of the internet cafes that still existed in Montenegro, plug in an external hard drive, and run his search through the installed search engine to minimize his trail. The Montenegrin government had provided him with passports and identities along with accompanying credit cards. He would miss the Balkans, but that was how one survived. You had to keep moving. There were other Ukrainian girls, no matter where he ended up. They were quite popular in the human trafficking trade. He had read that Eric Sawyer had passed away at an island home in the West Indies. Details were sparse, which was suspicious. Sawyer's death was disappointing. The Masada founder had sent him quite a few lucrative contracts over the past 2 years. Sawyer's death was also a sign. It was time for Nizar to leave Montenegro behind. He pulled a book from the shelf, a book he couldn't even read. The Great Game. It was written in English, a language he could not yet understand, though he was working on it. The book had been given to him 2 years earlier when he met with Sawyer in Africa. The American needed him to do a job, to eliminate a problem in Nigeria. Sawyer had also taught him a code. A note would arrive by courier. Inside were a series of numbers. An intelligence service could attempt to decipher it until the end of time. Its genius was its simplicity. Page number, line number, letter number. Even if someone knew how it worked, without the exact edition of the correct book, breaking it was impossible. Nizar flipped to page 176, ran his finger down to the eighth line, and then moved it across to the 12th letter. J. It took him a while, but by the end he had a page full of letters. Nizar had no idea what it said. There were no spaces between them, just a series of letters that only someone who could read and write English could break down into sentences. He returned to the small bedroom and nudged the naked blonde woman awake. "Translate," he said in Russian. A destination country for human trafficking, Montenegro was a waypoint for organized crime syndicates that routinely moved young girls and women from Ukraine, Serbia, and Bulgaria to Europe and the United States and into forced prostitution. Despite international pressure, the Balkan nation remained a hotbed for the growing industry. The young woman slipped from beneath the sheets and moved to the small desk in the main room. It was early and she needed her fix. At least he didn't beat her or put cigarettes out on her skin, nor did he cod or choke her or invite other men to join. Though she was never permitted to leave the flat, he treated her well. She cooked, cleaned, spread her legs, and taught him English. She sat naked at the bureau with the sun beginning to break through the thin curtains. It was going to be a beautiful day. After she was done, she'd make them breakfast. She liked the view from the kitchen, out over the city with a slice of the Adriatic Sea in the distance. Nizar started a kettle of water to make tea, keeping his eye on the lithe young figure at his desk. She circled the words, breaking the unending letters into coherent sentences. She then translated the English into Russian on a separate sheet of paper. By the time her tea was ready, she had finished her work. She handed the document to Nizar. The assassin held it up to the light and read. It was a contract. It was structured in a similar fashion to Nizar's other work for Sawyer. It informed the assassin that 2 million euros had been laundered through a yacht brokerage service in the British Virgin Islands to a construction company in Montenegro in the form of a fictitious invoice that would be paid to Nizar for consultation on an ongoing commercial development project. The money had already been deposited in the usual account. Unusual to this contract was that Nizar was free to leave it unfulfilled. With Sawyer being dead, that was certainly an incentive. The contract went on to state that another 6 million euros would be transferred upon completion of the job. Nizar thought of the cost associated with moving his operation from Montenegro to a place like Argentina if the current president was deposed, arrested, or killed, all of which were distinct possibilities. There was another sentence that stood out. The Mark is actively targeting you. It would be best if you found him before he finds you. Additional incentive? That was just like Sawyer. Was it true? Nizar read on. By the time he finished the document, he was certain of its veracity. He had connected the events in Odessa to the death of the SEAL to the news reports of a man who was now in the employ of the United States Intelligence Services, a man who had proven very hard to kill. He lit a match and held the papers to the flame. They caught easily, the fire creeping up the parchments until it threatened to burn the assassin's fingers. Moving to the kitchen, he dropped what was left into the sink and turned on the water. The faucet sputtered until it seemed to catch a second wind that was powerful enough to carry the charred remains of the contract into the pipes of the ancient city. The girl remained sitting at the small desk, sipping her hot tea. She'd learned early on to speak only if spoken to and to simply do exactly as she was instructed. She was a survivor. Nizar approached her from behind and stroked her hair. It felt good. She closed her eyes and smiled. Perhaps he would stay for longer this time and she wouldn't have to go back to the house with the other girls. That would be nice. Maybe if she proved worthy, he'd buy her outright? She would be sure to continue giving him nights to remember. His hand brushed softly down the left side of her head, past her cheek, and to the back of her neck. Maybe there truly was hope. The terror lasted only a second. Her eyes opened wide as he yanked her hair back, exposing the soft skin of her neck. He inserted the thin blade behind the windpipe, its sharp edge slicing completely through to the other side. Locking her body against the chair, he sawed outward, the way the Russian advisors had taught him in the Syria of his youth. She struggled only briefly, scratching at the hand that was taking her life, the blood rushing from her severed carotid artery draining down her breasts and spraying onto the desk in front of her in cadence with the beating of her heart. Nizar controlled her head as the pumping weakened. When her heart lost the strength to circulate blood through a failing system, the pressure subsided, and her hands fell to her sides. He looked once more into her dead eyes before letting her head drop to the desk. He'd have the Montenegrin Mafia clean it up. True, he would have to pay for her, but Sawyer's money would take care of that. There were always plenty of girls. With the founder of Masada dead, she was the only other person privy to the contract and the translated note. Only in death could she be trusted to keep the secret. No one would miss or mourn her. No loose ends. That was how Nizar stayed alive. He walked to the sink and washed the blood from his hands. He then cleaned the blade, wiped it dry with a towel, and returned it to a drawer. The sun had broken the horizon, an emerging dawn with a new contract for Nizar, his most profitable to date. It was time to study his prey. If what Sawyer had written was accurate, the man was already hunting him. To Nizar, killing Frederick Strain was business. He did not wish death to the infidels, like the true believers who sacrificed themselves for the cause. To his new mark, Strain's death had been personal. Nizar would use that to his advantage. His target's emotion was something he could exploit. Nizar was a sniper, a hunter of men, an assassin. He dropped the small thumb drive in his pocket and grabbed his coat. He closed and locked the apartment door behind him and smiled at an old woman who was already awake and sweeping the hall the way she did every morning. He descended the steps to the path that led to a winding road. It was time to buy a newspaper and a tea. It was time to think. He had a problem to solve, a problem to eliminate. As he walked the narrow stone streets of the port city, the final line of the contract echoed in the recesses of his mind. It would be best if you found him before he finds you. When the internet cafe opened, he would pay his 3 euro fee in coins, plug in the external search engine, and begin developing a pattern of life on Lieutenant Commander James Reese. Author's note. This is a work of fiction. Fiction with whispers of truth. On August 7th, 2020, Al-Qaeda's second-in-command, Abu Muhammad al-Masari, was assassinated. It is rumored that the gunmen were Israeli operatives acting with tacit or explicit support from the United States. Also killed in the assassination was the widow of Hamza bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's son. The assassination took place in Tehran, Iran. In the fall of 2017, I had a remarkable conversation with a man in Argentina. He will remain anonymous in this work, though he is mentioned by name in the 9/11 Commission report. He asked me how 19 foreign nationals could pass through security at 3 separate international airports and 1 regional airport, some even flagged for additional screening, and not have 1 report in subsequent investigations of a screener noticing a box cutter or knife. The regulations pertaining to knives allowed on aircraft prior to September 11, 2001 were confusing. Federal Aviation Administration regulations prohibited knives with blades 4 inches long or longer and/or knives illegal under local law. Seemingly in contradiction to that regulation was a non-regulatory checkpoint operations guide for screeners interpreting those FAA regulations and prohibiting box-cutting devices. For 19 terrorists to pass through screening without 1 security screener at least noticing a blade and ensuring it was of legal length struck him as odd. That conversation provided the basis for The Devil's Hand. The first sentence of the notes to Chapter 1 of the 9/11 Commission report reads, "No physical, documentary, or analytical evidence provides a convincing explanation of why Atta and Omari drove to Portland, Maine from Boston on the morning of September 10th. 20 years later, that question has still not been successfully answered. Mohammed Atta and Abdulaziz al-Omari took that secret with them to their graves. On the topic of Iranian involvement in 9/11, the report states, We have found no evidence that Iran or Hezbollah was aware of the planning for what later became the 9/11 attack. However, we believe this topic requires further investigation by the U.S. government. The report also notes that at least 8 of the 9/11 terrorists traveled to Iran between October 2000 and February 2001. Tehran is believed to have been a waypoint in travel to and from terrorist training camps in neighboring Afghanistan. There is evidence that suggests senior Hezbollah officials were aware of and actively tracking the travel of these al-Qaeda operatives. To what purpose remains unknown. Al-Qaeda, Iran, and Hezbollah have an incestuous history. The foundations of the relationship were laid in the early 1980s with the founding of Islamic Jihad, but were cemented during the 1990s when Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, then al-Qaeda's second-in-command, took refuge in Sudan. In the 1990s, Sudan was a breeding ground for terror. Chapter 2 of the 9/11 Commission report notes, in late 1991 or 1992, discussions in Sudan between al-Qaeda and Iranian operatives led to an informal agreement to cooperate in providing support, even if only training, for actions carried out primarily against Israel and the United States. Not long afterward, senior al-Qaeda operatives and trainers traveled to Iran to receive training in explosives. In the fall of 1993, another such delegation went to the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon for further training in explosives as well as in intelligence and security. From Sudan, al-Qaeda sent operatives to train in Iran and Lebanon. In April 1991, Ayman al-Zawahiri traveled to Iran and met with Hezbollah operations chief Imad Mughniyeh. Mughniyeh was responsible for the 1983 bombings of the U.S. Embassy and Marine Barracks in Beirut, the kidnapping and murder of CIA Lebanon Station Chief William F. Buckley, the hijacking of TWA Flight 847 in 1985, the 1992 suicide bombing of the Israeli Embassy in Buenos Aires, the 1994 attack on a Jewish community center in Argentina, and the 1996 Khobar Towers bombing in Saudi Arabia. Mughniyeh would later meet with bin Laden in Sudan, further bridging the Sunni-Shia divide and cementing the al-Qaeda connection with the regime in Tehran. 2 days prior to 9/11, Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance, was assassinated by 2 al-Qaeda operatives posing as journalists. A declassified, though heavily redacted, November 2001 Defense Intelligence Agency cable obtained through the Freedom of Information Act by the National Security Archive at George Washington University reads, "Through Northern Alliance intelligence efforts, the late Commander Massoud gained limited knowledge regarding the intentions of the Saudi millionaire Osama bin Laden and his terrorist organization al-Qaeda to perform a terrorist act against the U.S. on a scale larger than the 1998 bombing of the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania." Massoud's al-Qaeda assassins obtained their forged documents via the Iranian embassy in Brussels. One of the most damning pieces of evidence on Iran's complicity in 9/11 comes from a classified Iranian document dated May 2001, a transcript of which can be found in Ronan Bergman's The Secret War with Iran. The Islamic Republic of Iran, the intelligence apparatus of the Supreme Leader, top secret. Date May 14, 2001. Reference 4-325-80/S/M. By Head of the Intelligence Apparatus of the Supreme Leader, 2. Head of Operations Unit No. 43 in the Iranian Intelligence Ministry. Re. Orders regarding the decision of the Honorable Leader Khamenei. Dear Hujjat al-Islam wal-Muslimin Mustafa Purkanad, Director of General Operations, Unit No. 43. We wish your dedicated and courageous team every success. The results described in your recent reports have been examined along with other opinions. After consideration and in order to remove the existing lack of clarity regarding support for Al-Qaeda's future plans, the honorable leader has emphasized that the battle against the global arrogance headed by the U.S. and Israel is an integral part of our Islamic government and constitutes its primary goal. Damaging their economic systems, discrediting all other institutions of these two allied enemies of the Islamic government in Iran, as part of political confrontation with them, and undermining the stability and security of the U.S. and Israel are obligatory duties that must be carried out. The Honorable Leader Khamenei stressed the need for each of you to be vigilant in his field of activity and asks you to be particularly attentive. He also stressed the need to be alert to the possible negative future consequences of this cooperation between Iran and Al-Qaeda. The Honorable Khamenei said that this struggle must be stepped up by tightening the collaboration with other security and intelligence apparatuses in Iran and with supporters outside Iran, thereby hindering the enemy's steadily expanding activities. Khamenei further instructed that in carrying out your duties, you must operate under the direct supervision of the security division of the headquarters of the organization, i.e., the intelligence apparatus of the supreme leader. Naturally, identifying potential damage is the responsibility of the vigilant and diligent unit, number 43. It has also been decided that in the upcoming meetings, discussions must be held in order to formulate clear goals and remove the main obstacles and difficulties in achieving these goals and in promoting the issue of expanding the collaboration with the fighters of Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, Lebanon. Finally, I wish to convey Khamenei's full satisfaction with Unit Number 43 and his full support in the implementation of its future plans. The Honorable Khamenei is aware of the important and dangerous nature of the tasks you perform. He emphasizes that with regard to cooperation with Al-Qaeda, no traces must be left that might have negative and irreversible consequences, and that the activity must be limited to the existing contacts with Hezbollah Operations Officer Imad Mughniya and Bin Laden's deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri. May Allah grant you success. Seal and signature, Ali Akbar Natek Nuri. Ali Akbar Natek Nuri was the chief advisor on intelligence to Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran. Following the death of Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri ascended to lead Al-Qaeda. The United States Department of State has offered a reward of $25 million for information leading to al-Zawahiri's apprehension or conviction. At the time of this writing, he remains at large. I was well into the research for this novel before the COVID-19 pandemic gripped the world. I was investigating the weaponization of infectious diseases, particularly from the end of World War II through today. It did not escape notice when information began to emerge that a variant of coronavirus had emerged in a market in Wuhan, China, just 3 football fields from Wuhan's Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market, where China tells the world that the COVID-19 outbreak originated, is the Wuhan branch of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. That same market is less than 10 miles from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which houses China's only biosafety level 4 laboratory, called the Wuhan National Biosafety Laboratory. On February 16, 2020, Senator Tom Cotton said, "We have such laboratories ourselves in the United States run by our military, in large part done for preventative purposes or trying to discover vaccines or protect our own soldiers." The key part of the senator's interview is that we have such laboratories ourselves. Unintended release of biological and chemical weapons is not without precedent. In 1979, a Soviet research lab in what was then called Sverdlovsk in the Urals accidentally released anthrax, killing at least 100 people. The facility was using data from Imperial Japan's bioweapons program captured in Manchuria during World War II. The medical records of those exposed to anthrax were all edited to limit evidence that the Soviets were in violation of the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention, of which they were signatories. The deaths were explained away as coming from contaminated meat. In 1968, 6,000 sheep mysteriously died near Dugway Proving Ground in Utah. Dugway was established during World War II in an effort to counter the Axis biological and chemical weapons programs. It remains in existence today. The U.S. Army had been conducting open-air VX nerve agent testing in the days prior to what is now called the Skull Valley Sheep Kill. An internal Army investigation 2 years later would find that lethal chemical agents tested at Dugway on March 13, 1968, may have contributed to the sheep deaths. The history of biological weapons is both fascinating and chilling. Bioweapons data from Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany in World War II informed the U.S. and Soviet bioweapons programs of the Cold War years. In the spring of 2002, I was part of a small group of military personnel assigned to a training mission in Uzbekistan. As the junior member of the team, my job was to train up partner force snipers on the SDV, better known as the Dragunov. It was during this assignment to Uzbekistan that I first heard mention of an island on the Aral Sea, an island synonymous with bioweapon research. My later open-source research would indicate that this was Vozrozhdeniya Island, Rebirth Island, a former Soviet biological weapons test site called Aralsk 7. It is clear that the Soviets had not adhered to the United Nations treaty. The history of Marburg variant U described in The Devil's Hand is true. Dr. Nikolai Ustinov worked at the Vector Bioweapon Research Center in Koltsovo, Siberia. In April 1988, he accidentally injected Marburg into his thumb. He was immediately quarantined. Over the next 3 weeks, the virus liquefied his organs and drove him insane as it ate away his brain cells. Ever the scientist, he detailed his demise in a journal, its pages stained with blood, vomit, and mucus from his decaying body. Following his death, organ samples were taken. During his autopsy, a doctor pricked his skin with a needle that had extracted bone marrow. He was dead a month later. Upon further study, the samples of Marburg taken from Dr. Ustinov's organs appeared different from the original strain. The virus had evolved. It was now more virulent than the original. The Soviets weaponized this new strain and called it Variant U in honor of Dr. Ustinov. By all indications, the Soviet Union stepped up their bioweapon development and stockpiling programs following the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention. Biopreparat was the lead Soviet agency tasked with weaponizing infectious diseases. What happened to these programs with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991? What happened to the scientists who developed these programs? According to Dr. Ken Alibek, the deputy chief of Biopreparat from 1988 to 1992, many of his former colleagues relocated to the United States, Europe, and Asia, as economic conditions in Russia forced scientists to look for work beyond their borders. In Chapter 20 of his book, Biohazard, he writes, "In May of 1997, more than 100 scientists from Russian laboratories, including Vector and Obolensk, attended a biotechnology trade fair in Tehran. Soon after that, Iranians had visited Vector a number of times and were actively promoting scientific exchanges." How far along is the Iranian bioweapons program, and does the success of using proxies over the past four decades mean that Iran could or would use these weapons through non-state actors as an instrument of terror? It is certainly a possibility and should not be discounted. Has the United States remained in compliance with the 1972 Biological Weapon Convention? There is no international agency tasked with verification to monitor compliance. It's essentially the honor system. The convention bans bioweapon agents, toxins, weapons, equipment, and means of delivery. We would be naive to assume that classified bioweapons programs do not still exist. Interestingly, the language of what is officially called the Convention on the Prohibition of the Development, Production, and Stockpiling of Bacteriological, Biological, and Toxin Weapons, BTWC, does not ban biodefense weapons. Does the United States have protocols in place to eradicate a respiratory spread virus that threatens to kill 90% of the population? I don't know the answer to that question, but inferring what I can from the research for this novel, I would be surprised if those plans do not exist. If you were experimenting with the weaponization of viruses, even biodefense weapons, that had the potential to render the human race extinct, what would you do? Following the targeted assassination of Quds Force Commander General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said, "With his departure and with God's power, his work and path will not cease, and severe revenge awaits those criminals who have tainted their filthy hands with his blood." Iran does not forget. Of note, the United States signed the Biological Weapons Convention on April 10, 1972. The same day as Iran.
The Devil's Hand, a thriller, was written by Jack Carr and read by Ray Porter. Editing, mix, and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. The Devil's Hand was produced and directed by Travis Tunn. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Devil's Hand, a thriller, is available in print from Atria Emily Bestler Books. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Savage Son, a thriller, written by Jack Carr and read by Ray Porter.
Audible hopes